Welcome to the podcast series, Intel on AI. Each episode explores human-centric topics related to artificial intelligence through conversations with leaders in the field. I'm your host, Abigail Hing Nguyen. Today, I'm honored to speak with a legend in the field of artificial intelligence. Yann LeCun is often referred to as one of the godfathers of AI. He currently serves as vice president and chief AI scientist at Facebook, is a professor at NYU, and a recipient of the ACM Turing Award. Yann, can you tell us where you're speaking with me from today?
I'm speaking from our house in beautiful New Jersey near the Jersey Shore. And I'm sitting in my workshop right now, which is a huge mess.
Well, it sounds lovely. I'd love to be out there as well and travel the world again. Well, Yann, thank you so much for being here with me today. In episode 6, I spoke with your colleague, Jerome Pacenti at Facebook, and we got an inside look at what Facebook is doing. So for our discussion in particular, I'd love to move in a slightly different direction to spend some time getting your perspective on the modern history of this field, finishing off with where we are today and where you think we're headed. I know you've also given a number of interviews. Most recently, you did a fantastic interview with Don Song at ICLR 2020 on YouTube. So I would definitely refer our listeners to other of your works out there and other of your talks. So some stage setting for those listeners who are less familiar with the field. Your work, along with your fellow Turing Award winners, Jeff Hinton and Yasha Bengio, has laid the foundations for the field of AI today. Your work with computer vision especially has been talked about as enabling banks to read checks and change the game for financial services, enabled facial recognition to unlock phones. Where else might we be encountering your AI work being leveraged in the world around us?
So AI today is used absolutely everywhere. Every time you connect to an online service, there is some sort of deep learning AI system that essentially either arranges the content or picks the content that you are seeing, whether you're using a search engine or a social network or even a regular website or an e-commerce website. Those things also determine what ads are shown to you, but that's kind of a minor thing, although it's the engine of the internet to some extent. So a lot of things are kind of behind the scenes. And today, if you were to take deep learning, which is kind of the dominant modern form of AI, out of companies like Facebook, Google, or Amazon, the companies will essentially crumble. They're kind of really built around it today. But that's only part of the applications. Another one is a lot of cars nowadays, almost every car in Europe actually comes out with a computer vision system that can do sort of emergency early braking, right? So if a pedestrian crosses the street in front of you, the car will automatically brake so you don't run over the pedestrian or the bike or whatever. Those use deep learning systems as well. And increasingly, you see a lot of experimental systems that will become practical in the next few years to do things like detecting tumors in medical images and things like that. And of course, there's a lot of mobile apps that people are downloading all the time that use AI to, let's say, you can take a picture of a, you know, leaf of a plant and it will tell you what species of plant or bird or insect it is. All of those use recent advances. And then, of course, you know, there's sort of visible things like you go on Facebook, for example, and a friend of yours makes a post in a language you don't understand and you get a translation of it in a language you do understand. That's also done with AI.
Right. I actually have used that very recently, and it's amazing how it really opens the world for us, and it continues to change the world for us. So taking us all the way back in time, where would you set the marker for the beginning of the modern era of artificial intelligence? Like, when would you say artificial intelligence was first invented?
Well, there's been ups and downs. The idea that machines could be the substrate for the mechanization of thought goes back to the 1930s and 40s with, you know, the work of Turing and McCulloch and Pitts and things like that. So Turing was more from what has become traditional computer science, how you mechanize computation, so thought is just another computation. And then the McCulloch and Pitts came from neuroscience and said the type of computation that takes place in neurons can be seen as a computation. And we can imagine that circuits of neurons could do, for example, logical reasoning. And so those two ideas kind of move forward. Simultaneously, there was people in the, you know, late 40s working on what became to be known as cybernetics, which was the science of basically how parts of a system communicate with each other, the idea of feedback, the idea of autopoiesis, the idea of regulation, the idea of learning and adaptation. And all of those created sort of a wave of interest in AI in the 1950s. The phrase AI, you know, appeared in 1956 following a conference of a bunch of people interested in this question. And there was sort of those two parallel approaches, one that was more sort of, let's get inspired by biology, let's try to reproduce or get inspiration from how the brain works, let's try to get machines to learn, things like that. And then the other branch was more from, you know, what became kind of classical computer science, let's figure out how to reproduce logical reasoning and things like that with computer programs. And those kind of developed in parallel. And there's been lots of ups and downs of kind of relative successes of those two approaches. So the sort of machine learning approach was somewhat popular in the late 50s, early 60s, and then died. And then it reappeared in the mid 80s, which is when I started my career. And, you know, Jeff Hinton had been at it for a few years. Yashua Bindu, you know, came a little later. And that was somewhat popular for about 10 years until the mid 90s. And then it died again. And then it reappeared around 2010, roughly. First with really big success in speech recognition, then in image recognition a few years later, and then in natural language processing, and now in robotics and a number of other types of applications. So it's been there's been a lot of ups and downs, you know, back and forth.
And so what kept you going in a time when most people thought the technology's prospects were so dim?
When I started getting interested in AI, I had this preconceived idea that it was too difficult for people to sort of engineer an intelligent system from scratch, and that necessarily that system should basically train itself, should be capable of learning. I thought very early on that learning was inseparable from intelligence. And so that got me interested in learning right away. And I realized when I started getting into this in the early 80s, that essentially nobody was working on machine learning. This was barely a phrase that people dared to use. And so this idea sort of, you know, started becoming popular in the late 80s because of the appearance of somewhat successful applications of neural networks and the backpropagation learning algorithm, which basically lifted the limitations of whatever was done in the 60s. And so there was kind of a flurry of excitement about this, but it was pretty clear quickly that the kind of applications we could solve with this were in relatively small number because those systems required quite a lot of data to be trained, and that was expensive. This was before the internet, so you didn't have free data, but just, you know, scouring the internet. And computers were not nearly as fast as they are now. And the software to kind of simulate those neural nets was difficult to write and took a lot of effort. So only a few teams actually succeeded in having practical commercial applications of neural nets. So one of them was some of the work I did with my colleagues at AT&T on character recognition, handwriting recognition.
I think one of the challenges for research in any new technologies, we never really know if we're going to be successful or not. And what was the thinking at the time? Like, what was the hope for this new technology that you were working on? I'm curious to hear whether you think we've realized some of those early dreams.
So once we started having some success with conventional nets for shape recognition, things like handwriting recognition, I really thought that this would be applicable very widely to image recognition once we were going to have powerful enough computers and enough data. But few people actually believed in this, partly because a lot of people didn't have the means to really sort of implement neural nets and try them out in the right way. It wasn't common to share your code in open source at the time, for example. So people had to re-implement their own thing. And so there was a bit of a disaffection for those methods because it was complicated to make them work. And so there was this black period between the mid-90s and the mid-2000s when essentially neural nets were not only ignored, but even mocked sometimes. And people like me and Jeff, Yoshua sometimes, and Jörg Schmiedeber and a bunch of other people, you know, Leo Batu and others, were sometimes seen as marginal, you know, crazy people who still cling to neural nets. I actually stopped working on neural nets between 96 and 2002. There was no interest in it. But I was sure that it was going to come back. And so when I left industry and joined academia in 2003, Jeff, Yoshua, and I sort of got together and started, you know, kind of mockingly called the deep learning conspiracy, which basically was an attempt at convincing the research community that neural nets actually worked. And we sort of renamed this deep learning because the techniques we were promoting were a little more general than the sort of old traditional neural nets.
And what was it that kept you going for, say, researchers today who are struggling with their own, you know, crazy ideas and needing to convince others? Like, how was it that you knew that this was the thing to move forward?
Well, it was an intimate belief, first of all, that this was the right thing, but also considerable empirical evidence on our side, which was not perhaps completely visible or trusted by other researchers. So, you know, there is this data set called MNIST, which has become a bit of a benchmark to test, you know, new ideas about machine learning. And, you know, it's a data set of handwritten digits. And, you know, the best methods on this data set always were convolutional neural nets, you know, multilayer neural nets of a particular architecture. They were never beaten by anything else. Other techniques like support vector machines came really close, but were never really better. And so there was evidence from us that this was working. I had done some other experiments in things like face detection and other types of applications that clearly showed that those things worked. But those results were kind of easily dismissed by people who are kind of more interested in other methods, who were thinking eventually our methods will beat those and, you know, it's only temporary that you get better results. So we had considerable empirical evidence, as well as, you know, a sort of heuristic belief, if you want, that those methods were the right thing to do. The main reason was traditional methods rely on engineering what's called a front end or a feature extractor that represents an image or a speech signal or something into something that can be palatable by simple learning systems. And what deep learning allowed us to do on neural nets in general, convolutional nets in particular, was to basically train the system end to end. So we didn't have to hand engineer the front end. It would be just the result of learning. That seemed like an obvious idea, and it is now, but it took about 20 years to convince the community that that was a good idea.
And what was it that convinced them in the end? And is there any way now looking back that we could compress that?
Empirical results. So this technique started to yield really good results on speech recognition around 2009. And then, you know, beat the record for ImageNet in late 2012. In fact, there were good results before on other vision tasks, but they were not vision tasks that the computer vision community paid much attention to, on things like, you know, detecting pedestrians or doing semantic segmentation, you know, with small data sets or recognizing road signs. I mean, there was kind of a lot of applications like this, but the computer vision community really, really cared about ImageNet and Pascal VOC challenges and other benchmarks that were really the thing. So the day convolutional nets, you know, coming out of Jeff Hinton's lab, beat the record on ImageNet or won the competition by a large margin, a lot of people got convinced that day, essentially. This was in October in Florence in a workshop at ECCV in 2012.
And so when you look back from that point, when you look back on the modern history of artificial intelligence, what surprises you the most?
So there is a lot of things that modern deep learning methods work very well for, which I did not believe initially, even only 7 years ago, that they would work. So for example, I was convinced that convolutional nets, for example, would be good for sort of generic category classification. You know, you want to get a machine to tell you if the image contains a car or a table or a chair or an animal of some particular species, right? But it turns out you can do fine-grained classification with deep learning. So you can do things like face recognition. You can do things like, you know, tell the species of a plant, a bird, or an insect with a picture. And then you can do things that I knew we were eventually going to be able to do, which is, you know, basically label every pixel in an image with the category of the object that it belongs to. So this is called panoptic semantic segmentation, or simply semantic segmentation, or instance segmentation. So you basically have a complete description of the image where every region in the image is labeled with a category. And that works amazingly well. So, you know, that was not too surprising. The fine-grained classification was very surprising to me. And then what was even more surprising was the current performance of natural language processing systems. So the fact that today we have pretty good translation systems that can translate, you know, at least 100 languages into another 100 languages with a single neural net. Okay, it's a single neural net that does this translation and does it pretty well, much better than other techniques that were devised before. To me, that's absolutely amazing. And that's a progress of the last year or two. In fact, there is a system from Facebook that was open source just this last week that actually translates from 100 languages to another 100 languages, including languages for which there is very little training data, including pairs of languages for which we have absolutely no training data whatsoever. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, that is fascinating. I saw that. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that works and why it's been successful?
The progress in natural language processing. So there was an initial excitement about using neural net in NLP. And the idea goes back a long time. It goes back to some of Yoshua Bengio's work in the early 2000s when he trained a language model to predict what the next word is going to be in a text and got some really good performance. And then there was some really kind of groundbreaking work by Ronan Colobert and Jason Weston, who are now at Facebook. At the time, they were at the NEC Research Institute in Princeton. And they figured out they could train what basically was a convolutional net to represent text in such a way that you could then train a text classification system or parsing system from those representations that were trained completely unsupervised or self-supervised. The way they would train the system is that they would show a sequence of words to a system and then tell it, this is a good sentence. And then they would substitute a word in the middle of that sequence of words and then tell the system, this is a bad sentence. It's nonsensical because the word in the middle is not the right one. And by just training the system to distinguish between good sequences of words that appear in actual text and nonsensical sequences, the system develops a good representation of text, which is pretty amazing. So that was sort of the first example of self-supervised learning applied to NLP. Then there were kind of some work by Tomasz Mikolov and his colleagues at Google on Word2Vec, which is sort of a similar idea with a much simpler architecture. It was not a convolutional net. It was kind of a simpler linear predictor. Then some work at Facebook on FastText, which is sort of an improvement on this. And so the idea that you could use self supervised learning to train a natural language processing system sort of made its way. People like Ilya Sutskever and his colleague at Google demonstrated in late 2014 that you can train a very large recurrent neural net of the type called LSTM to do translation. And he started to get results that were on par with more traditional statistical methods for translation. And that really kind of spurred a wave of interest in using neural nets for NLP. That made a huge amount of progress. So Yoshua Bengio's lab, Kyung-Yung Cho, who was a postdoc at the time, and Dimitri Badanow proposed this idea of attention a year later, which allowed to use amazingly efficient NLP system for translation. That was picked up by all the companies in the world that were interested in translation. Within just a few months, all of those companies, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, everybody, had translation system based on recurrent neural nets and attention. And then the other revolution came a couple of years later with the idea that you can basically just have an architecture just entirely based on attention. So this was a paper by Devlin from Google, whose title was Attention is All You Need, and proposed this transformer architecture that has become very popular. And it built on an idea that was proposed at Facebook actually a few years earlier of essentially integrating associative memory modules inside of a neural net. In a transformer, it's basically a bunch of layers of groups of neurons that essentially implement trainable associative memories. That turned out to be incredibly successful. And then there was the sort of groundbreaking paper by Waswani on the BERT system, which used a technique called denoising autoencoder, which was actually proposed by Pascal Vincent from Yoshua Bengio's lab, but it was very similar to the Colbert and Weston technique to train one of those systems self-supervised to represent text. And that turned out to be incredibly powerful. So a lot of people picked that up, you know, including everybody at Facebook and a lot of other people. And that's what enabled sort of recent progress in translation, in text understanding, in dialogue systems. Those systems have been demonstrated to be useful even for essentially unsupervised translation and for things like you would not expect a neural net to be able to do, like computing integrals symbolically or solving differential equations symbolically, which was demonstrated by Guillaume Lample and François Charton at Facebook in Paris last year. So those are really kind of amazing progress that I would not have expected.
It's very fascinating. I completely agree with you. It's amazing breakthroughs. And what I also love about them is that they continue to democratize our resources. So this ability to translate more accurately among multiple languages. We had an earlier podcast with the World Bank. And, you know, one of the challenges of reaching the developing world with the resources of artificial intelligence is some of those language barriers. So it does feel like a lot of these steps that we're taking to make these things simpler for people to use or simpler to overcome some of these other natural barriers in the world is incredible progress on a social level as well.
It's an interesting change of attitude in sort of industry and university research that now most of the research in AI, or at least the leading edge research, is released with code in open source, which is really usable by everyone. So pretty much all the research papers you'll see coming out of FAIR, Facebook AI Research, will come with open source code that is really usable. And the effect of this is to accelerate the progress of AI as a whole, right? So you'll see, let's say Google publishes a technique and then within 3 months, Facebook has an improvement on it. And within 3 months of that, Google has yet another improvement on it and they use each other's ideas. We use different platforms, so we don't necessarily use the same code, but academics can use this code, other companies can use this code. And so I had something to do with it. Like I was really insistent when I created FAIR at Facebook that research should be open. And I think it had an effect on the rest of the industry.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, I was actually very struck that you have successfully remained friends and colleagues and was even jointly awarded the Turing Award. And I think, you know, in the tech world, the AI community does tend to be very collaborative. And so how do you advise people, you know, young researchers when there's fierce competition among companies within labs, entrepreneurs who are in the trenches of startup companies and feeling that squeeze of competition? Like, how do you advise them and encourage this type of open source in the face of that type of pressure?
So, you know, open source came out of academia, really. So, I mean, not really, but it's been practiced for a while by academics. So it's kind of a natural thing in academia to share the results of your research because the currency in academia is impact on the scientific world and the technology world. You know, it's not money, it's impact. And it turns out for forward-looking research labs, like you can find in the big companies that practice open research, it's also impact. I discovered this at Bell Labs when I was working there, that the ability of a lab to hire the best scientist essentially hinges on its reputation, and the reputation hinges on the intellectual impact. And the intellectual impact, of course, hinges on what you teach the world through publications and code and things like that. And in the end, the value of a technology for a company that can afford a fundamental research lab is not in whether you are 3 months ahead of your competitor, but whether you can deliver the product that people want. And right now in AI, the main issue is not whether Facebook's content filtering is better than Google's content filtering. They're pretty much very similar. But the question is whether we have a good enough content filtering that will work, whether our translation system is good enough that people will want to use it, whether we have the technology to build interactive virtual assistants that can help people in their daily lives and answer any question they have. We don't have the technology for this. We don't even have the science. And so we need to essentially help the rest of the community make progress by, you know, disseminating our knowledge and our tools.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And before we leave some of the history of the historical conversation, maybe a bit more personally, a successful career is going to come with many challenging decisions about the time and the energy that you spend along the way. In your career in artificial intelligence, are there any bridges that you've burned that you don't regret burning?
Well, you know, every time you have a choice to make in life, you know, there's generally sort of a risky option and a less risky option. Mm-hmm. And the way I made decisions is I always kind of choose the options that I was the least likely to regret to not have taken. Okay, so let me take a concrete example. I've met many people in my career who came to me and said, like, I'm fascinated by research. I had a chance to do a PhD and I chose not to and I regret it. I have absolutely never seen anyone ever come to me and say, I did a PhD and I regret it. I wasted my time. Okay, so I'm not saying that everybody should do a PhD, right? That's not what I mean. But the point is, you know, there are things you will regret not doing. And if you have some inkling that you should do them, you should do them. So that's a bit what I've used to kind of drive my life. If there is something you strongly believe in, you should pursue it. And I probably didn't realize early enough until I joined Bell Labs, which was, you know, after a PhD and a postdoc, that there is a lot to science that consists in explaining people in very clear terms what you're doing and helping them basically build on your work. Coming from sort of a French culture where, you know, mathematical sophistication is really the thing that everybody admires, you have to have a paper that's full of equations. And if people don't understand, it's their fault. So coming to Bell Labs, you know, I realized this is not the way it works. The way it works is you have to sell your ideas and people are not going to steal your ideas. You're going to have to ram it through their throat for them to accept it because, you know, people prefer their own ideas. They don't want yours. So being a bit of a geek, you know, I thought you write something, you publish it, and regardless of where you publish it, you know, people should know it exists. And it's just unfortunately not the way it works.
So you did mention being from France. And I know one of the things I'd love to hear about is like, how does your perspective as an immigrant, like you've set up a lab with global offices, how does that perspective as a person between cultures impact the work that you're doing? And how do you bring your full self to the table?
So I think diversity in background and culture is very important for research because research thrives on sort of doing things differently from what people were doing before. And so the more different perspectives you can get in a research group, the better it is. Either technical background, so people who are more, you know, mathematical, people who are more kind of practical, people who know how to make things work, people who are creative, you know, people who know how to explain. So, you know, it takes a village basically. And the way you build, particularly an industrial lab where people tend to be very collaborative, is that you try to have people of all kinds of different types, if you want, collaborating with each other and complementing each other. So, for example, a lot of my best work has been in collaboration with my friend Léon Boutou. And this is since I was finishing my PhD and he was starting his graduate studies back in 1987. And, you know, we're very complementary. He's much better at math and coding than I am. I'm probably better at explaining stuff than he was at the time. He's great now. And, you know, perhaps also simplifying ideas or coming up with new concepts. There aren't many things that I'm better at than Léon. Léon is really an amazing guy. But, you know, collaborating with people, you know, basically you should seek complementary skills. It's more difficult in academia because in academia, every professor with their students and postdocs and groups is basically an island, right? There is some collaboration, but less than there is in industry. And so the type of interaction there is very different. So to come back to the sort of cultural question, yeah, there is a strong emphasis on sort of, you know, mathematics in France. And perhaps I profited from this a little bit, although I'm not at all a mathematician and certainly not a theoretician. Certainly working at Bell Labs initially was a completely eye-opening experience for me where I discovered, you know, Bell Labs was kind of a mythical place at the time, talking in the late 80s, where, you know, all the technology of the modern world was essentially invented. And I learned how you do research. I learned that open research is a good thing to do. I learned that when you let creative people work on what they think is interesting, you get surprising results that can revolutionize the world. Whereas if you tell them from above what to work on, you never get surprising results. You get progress in technology, but you don't get breakthroughs. That's a lesson I learned and I applied when I created Facebook AI Research almost 7 years ago now.
That's great. And my team at Intel was very much run the same way. And I think Steve Jobs, I've been seeing his quote. I posted his quote as well about you hire smart people to tell you what to do, not the other way around.
Right. Although Apple never really had sort of fundamental research labs. So it's a little more top-down because it's more engineering oriented.
So moving forward in time a bit to some of the ongoing challenges with innovation, you speak a lot about self-supervised learning and about, you know, the challenges of current processes of taking too many trials to train a human to do what a child or a teenager could learn in just a few, such as identifying an elephant or learning to drive a car, which would only take a human about 30 hours, but could take a machine thousands of inputs. And I would love to kind of do a double click on this for you. What are the big opportunities and challenges that you're seeing in self-supervised learning? And how do you think, and why do you think it will be more successful in your view?
So we clearly already see the advantage of self-supervised learning in NLP, right? So this sort of, you know, denoising autoencoder or masked autoencoder approach of inaugurated by BERT or by Kotobe and Weston before that, combined with transformer architecture, clearly has brought something that has changed people's mind a lot about self-supervised learning. So what's happened in the last few years is people have tried to sort of transform that, avoiding a bad pun, transform this success into a success in image recognition. So, you know, can we use self-supervised learning to train a system to learn good features, good representations of images or video? And so far, it's been somewhat unsuccessful, or at least until about a year ago. So people try to use the same idea, transformers. You take an image, you mask out a piece of it, and then you train a neural net to reconstruct the pieces that are missing. Or you do this with video frames, for example. The features you get out of this process are not very good. So if you use the features obtained that the system learns to represent those images as input to a classification system for recognizing objects, for example, it doesn't work very well. So the progress that happened in the last year or so is the use of something I call Siamese networks, which I proposed in the early 90s for things like signature verification. The idea was not used for many years. I tried to revive it in the mid-2000s, but not with much success. But in the last year or so, there's been a flurry of interest in those methods. So the idea is that you have two identical neural nets, or almost identical neural nets, and you show those two neural nets, those two convolutional nets, let's say, two images that are essentially transformations of each other, right? So one is, you know, a picture of a dog, and the other one is a slightly modified version of the same dog, perhaps translated, scaled, a little bit rotated, the colors are changed a little bit. And you train those two neural nets to produce identical outputs. So if you just do this, the neural net will not learn anything. It will just learn to produce a constant vector. That's what we call the collapse problem. So what you have to do is, one technique is to use what's called contrastive learning, where you also show pairs of images that you know are different. You run them through those two identical copies of the neural net, and you tell the system, whatever output you're producing, make those two outputs different from each other, move them away from each other, right? So you keep training the system with lots and lots of similar pairs of images and dissimilar pairs of images. And eventually the system learns to represent images in such a way that the vector at the output corresponds to identity. So the nearest neighbors to a particular vector are all of the same category, if you want. So then you use this vector or some other layer in the network as input to a classifier, and it works relatively well. There's a number of techniques that appeared over the last year. Three from Facebook, actually, one called Deep Cluster, another one called Pearl, another one called Moco. And those methods actually get pretty decent results, although Deep Cluster is sort of a slightly different technique than the one I described. And then another technique appeared from Google called SimClear. And this one used much more training and sort of got really, really good results. But it basically was an indication that those methods are running into a wall in the sense that the number of negative samples you have to show those systems is so huge that the training is really, really expensive, and it may not generalize to kind of more complex problems like video. So people have started to look for other methods that did not involve this contrastive phase. And there are two that have the top performance at the moment in this scenario where you pre-train the system in this self-supervised manner, and then you use the representation as input to a classifier for ImageNet object detection, for object recognition, for example. Those two methods, one comes from DeepMind, it's called BYOL, that means bootstrap your own latent. And the other one comes from Facebook AI Research in Paris, and it's called Suave. And they're very different in the way they operate, but they get pretty much the same performance. And they approach the performance that an image recognition system purely trained on ImageNet, purely supervised, gets, even though the only thing you train is basically a linear classifier on top of the representation. So, you know, there is kind of quick progress. So that's one huge progress. And then the other huge progress, which only appeared in the last few months and weeks, is a system that also came out of Facebook AI Research in Paris called DETR, D-E-T-R. And this system is a vision system that does object localization and detection and recognition. And it works by combining a convolutional neural net as a front end with a transformer at the back end that is trained at the image level to basically tell you, you know, where the objects in the image are. And it doesn't require it to be told exactly where the objects are. It can sort of figure this out by itself during training. I think this is the future of computer vision. It's going to be, you know, a combination of convolutional net at the front end and a transformer at the back end. The advantage of transformer is that they kind of implement some sort of reasoning-like operations without throwing away differentiability. So it's compatible with gradient descent. You can backpropagate gradient through a transformer. And this vision system is the first one that is basically trainable completely end-to-end and works quite well.
It's amazing, actually. And I have Digital Domain coming to speak about virtual humans on an upcoming episode. What is the implication of all this for you? Like, where do you see this leading? And what is the holy grail out of these breakthroughs?
Well, so the holy grail, I think, is once we find a reliable technique that really can do self-supervised learning for a large spectrum of different types of data, right? I'm not just talking about images or video or speech or text, but just about anything, okay? So once we have that, we might have a way to train a machine to figure out how the world works, to basically understand how the world works by observation, okay? By watching videos, let's say, right? So when you watch a video, there's a lot of information about how the world works, right? You quickly realize that the world is three-dimensional because it's the best way to explain how the view that you see changes when the camera moves. So you quickly realize that every object has a depth, right? And if you know that objects have a depth, then you know that, you know, because of parallax motion, the background moves less than the foreground. And so the notion of objects and occlusion edges kind of jumps at you. So the fact that there are objects in the world that are independent of the background is a consequence of the fact that the world is three-dimensional. And you can just learn this by learning to predict videos. And you can imagine that, you know, you can build upon this, right? Once you know there are objects whose trajectory is predictable, objects whose trajectory is non-predictable, they are animate objects. There are, you know, things like gravity, right? You realize quickly that objects that are not supported will fall. It takes human babies about 9 months to figure this out, that objects that are not supported actually fall. And they learn this mostly by observation with very little interaction, at least in the first few months of life. So this type of learning, we don't really know how to reproduce in machines. And, you know, it's a form of self-supervised learning, but the type of self-supervised learning that we have access to today is not powerful enough to really kind of explain the type of learning that we observe in humans and animals. What I think is that as humans and animals learn how the world works through this type of self-supervised learning, you know, there's an accumulation of a huge amount of background information about the world, which perhaps is the basis of common sense. So the holy grail is a machine that has common sense.
Ah,
a machine that, you know, realizes that when you have a glass full of water, you know, on the table and you push on it, it's going to fall and everything below it is going to get wet and it's going to take a while to get drier. You know, you don't need to type this in text to realize this is true. So there's a lot you know about the world that is just due to your sort of visual interaction with it or sensory interaction more than text.
To what extent are we now able to use videos to train machines and to teach them about the world?
I mean, there have been attempts at basically training a system to predict what happens in the video in the hope that the features that would be learned would be useful for a subsequent image recognition task. And I have like maybe half a dozen papers myself on this, if not more, actually. But I cannot say that those attempts have been successful. So in the sense that you can get a sort of decent performance at, you know, predicting a few frames in the future, you know, particularly if you don't do it at the pixel level, but you do it at, say, the sort of mid-level feature level. But the features that are learned in the process of this type of training are not particularly useful for other tasks. So one of the things I've worked on is, can we use this type of training a system to predict what's going to happen, you know, a continuation of a video, for example, as a way to give a system the ability to predict what's going to happen in the world, but also the consequences of its action so that you can use it as a basis of reasoning and planning a sequence of actions. It's a very classical thing in optimal control that when you want to control a rocket or an airplane, you have a complete physical mathematical model of the dynamics of this airplane or rocket. And with a computer, you can sort of plan a sequence of commands that will, you know, get the rocket to rendezvous with the space station or something like that. So if you had a model of the world, perhaps you could infer a sequence of actions that will arrive at a particular result. I'm not talking about reinforcement learning here. I'm talking about optimal control. The problem is, what is your model of the world? How do you learn your model of the world? And the main technical issue we're facing here is how we deal with uncertainty. So the world is not entirely predictable. And a lot of things, you know, can happen. If you look at me talking right now, you know, I could be moving my head to the left or to the right. I could be moving my hands in front of my face. And a lot of those things are not entirely exactly predictable. So you need a machine. If you want to train a machine to do this kind of prediction, it has to be able to predict not a single point, but a set of plausible futures. And we don't really know how to do this efficiently. That's the main hurdle we're facing.
How far away do you think we could be from a machine that has common sense?
It's a very difficult question to answer because we would have to define really what level of common sense actually qualifies as common sense, right?
So, yes, fair.
You know, I don't know if you have a cat, but your house cat has some level of common sense, much better than the smartest AI machines that we have. You know, they know a lot about the dynamics of the world, right? They wouldn't be able to all the things that they do if not. So the question is really, what is common sense? But I think the question really is, when will we figure out how to train a predictive system that can deal with uncertainty and basically train itself by just, let's say, watching video? We know how to do this with text. This is basically what the BERT system type systems are doing. They predict missing words, you know, GPT-1, 2, 3, all the language models predict the next word in a text. And so they're basically trained that way. We know how to deal with uncertainty with discrete signals like text because the uncertainty as to what word is coming after a segment of text is basically a large probability vector with, you know, one probability for every possible word in the dictionary. And we know how to represent this with computers. It's just a big vector of numbers between 0 and 1 that sum to 1. We don't know how to represent such a distribution over all possible video frames.
It's too large a problem right now to solve.
Yeah, it's, you know, the problem of representing high-dimensional probability density functions, you know, in high-dimensional spaces. We don't know how to kind of represent the useful ones. We know how to represent simple ones that are useless, but the complex ones that would be necessary, we have a hard time representing them. So there's been a lot of hope over the last 5 years in the GAN idea, right? Generative adversarial networks, which was kind of a bit of a breakthrough in sort of attempting to represent distributions in high-dimensional continuous spaces. There's been sort of more progress more recently on what's called reversible models, things like normalizing flows and things like that. But I don't think it's the ultimate answers. I think we're still looking for basically a recipe or perhaps new math, right? So what I've been proposing is to basically throw away the sort of conceptual framework of probability theory and sort of use something a little more general but simpler called energy-based models. But, you know, the jury is still out.
And you've talked a bit about energy-based models. Can you explain for our listeners what that is?
Right. So let's say putting ourselves in this context of video prediction, right? So we observe a segment of a video, let's call that X. Okay. This is observed. And then we ask the system predict the rest, you know, how the video is going to continue. And let's call that Y. There are many Ys that are compatible with X, essentially. Okay. We cannot just train a neural net to take X, then compute an output, a prediction for Y, let's call it Y bar, and just decide that this is our prediction because that's a single point, that's a single image, a single frame of video. And we know that a lot of different possible things could happen. So how do we represent a set of possible outputs instead of a single one? So the first idea is you don't have a neural net produce directly a prediction for Y. You have a neural net of a particular structure that takes X and Y, and you give it a particular Y, and it tells you whether this Y is good, is compatible with X or not. So if it's compatible with X, it gives you a low energy. And if it's incompatible with X, if it's not a good continuation for the initial segment of the video, it gives you a high energy. The training problem becomes basically train a parameterized model, a neural net of some kind, that has a single output, the energy output, to produce low energy on a training sample of X and Y, so a video and its continuation, and to produce a higher energy when you show it X, but a different Y. And the difficulty of this is this second part. How do you make sure that the energy is large when the Y that you show is not a good continuation of X? And this problem is exactly identical to the problem I mentioned earlier in the context of Siamese nets and contrastive learning. You know, in this Siamese nets, you show pairs of examples that are the similar image, and then you also have to have those contrastive samples that tell the system, okay, those two images are not similar at all. And so whatever representation you compute should be different. It's exactly the same problem mathematically. It's learning basically an energy function, energy landscape that takes low values on good things and high values on bad things. And that's what we're struggling with. The right way to do it is not entirely clear.
Yeah, that's very new. Where can people learn more about this?
There is no kind of all-encompassing paper. I'm sorry to say, I should probably have written one, you know, probably 2 years ago, but it's coming soon. on this sort of general idea. So I did write a tutorial on energy-based model back in 2005, which was mostly in the context of supervised learning and what's called structured prediction. But the math essentially applies also to self-supervised learning. You know, if Y is an image instead of a label, it's the same mathematics. So that can be a good reference point. Another thing is a series of talks I've given about this over the last year or so, and also a course that I taught at NYU together with Alfredo Candiani, who's junior faculty and postdoc at NYU. So this is a course I taught at NYU on deep learning last semester in the spring of 2020. And the entire material is online together with, you know, PyTorch, Jupyter notebooks and all that, and practicums where Alfredo basically tries to explain the stuff that I explain at a high level. And there are two lectures on energy-based models. So if you're interested in the concept, you can watch those. Actually, this course is even transcribed in like a dozen languages. So you can also read that.
That's fantastic. So we have just a few minutes left, and I'd love to hear about the future. What are your thoughts on the future of this field? What are your fears in particular? And then I'd love to hear what are the things that you're excited about?
Well, so I'm excited about self-supervised learning. I'm excited about energy-based model as a way to sort of move forward, as I explained. I'm excited about all the recent progress in NLP in particular, in vision that we're foreseeing with this DITER type system and similar ones. I'm excited about the fact that deep learning today saves lives. So we have those early emergency braking systems in cars. We have those medical image analysis system. NYU and Facebook have produced a system that can accelerate the collection of data for an MRI. So instead of sitting in an MRI machine for an hour, you can just, you know, stay 15 minutes and the radiologist will have the same amount of information. So, I mean, there are things like this that I think are going to make the world really better. There is a lot of exciting things in science as well, in molecular biology, in physics, in chemistry, in material science, where deep learning is sort of helping scientists sort of design new materials, new drugs, things like that. There is a thing that just appeared today, actually, from FAIR, where people from FAIR actually developed what's called a neural relational model that predicts the spread of the COVID pandemic at the county level a week or two in advance and sort of allows government to do sort of, you know, resource allocation and things like this and perhaps take measures to sort of compensate for it. So I see a lot of good being done in the world with AI. I mean, people tend to, you know, focus on all the bad things like bias and stuff like that. But like, you know, you have to think about all the goods that this makes as well, right? Not to minimize the issues with bias, you know, you can certainly misuse AI in many ways. And there is too many examples of this, I'm afraid.
What would you say to concerns about a fear of a dystopian future? I think I know where you might go with this, just hearing your talks on what mountains remain to reach human level intelligence. But that is a real fear for some of the population still.
I mean, there's two kinds of fears. You know, the first one is the Terminator scenario, right? Where, right. You know, machines become, you know, super intelligent and they want to take over the world. Or maybe they don't even want to take over the world, but they, you know, they kill us like we kill an ant by not even seeing it and stepping on it, you know, which is an argument that some people have said. I don't believe in this scenario at all because I don't believe, first of all, that machines will have all the trappings of human nature. So things like the classical Hollywood scenario that an intelligent machine wants to basically become the leader and take over or wants to escape, you know, it's prisoner in something and because it's curious, it wants to escape. This is projecting human nature on machines. But this human nature is built into us by evolution for the survival of our species. There is absolutely zero reason for intelligent machines to have the same drives. So the drive of curiosity, for example. You know, I mean, dogs are not nearly as curious as cats. And it's in the nature of cats to be curious. It's because they have a piece of their brain that drives them to be curious.
Right. And yet we are working on that, right? We are trying to cultivate curiosity in machines as another way of learning.
Yeah, because curiosity, of course, helps you learn. You know, babies kind of do experiments to figure out, you know, how the world works. And that's driven by curiosity. You know, humans are known to be curious as well. But the thing is, it doesn't have to be a drive that you need to hardwire into a machine for it to be intelligent, even super intelligent in some ways. The other scenario is that, you know, even in the context of humanity, you know, this is a joke I often say, but in the context of humanity, it is not the most intelligent humans that want to be the leaders, right? I mean, we have examples of this in the international political scene at the moment. So, you know, intelligence is not at all correlated with the desire to take over. Most of my colleagues, you know, are probably the smartest people I've ever encountered. And, you know, none of them wants to be the chief of anything. You have to twist their arm for them to become managers, right? I'm sure you're familiar with
right,
that concept.
Right. That is true, actually. I do know many people like that.
That's right. So that scenario, I think, is not in the cards. Then there is a scenario that, you know, people's jobs are going to be taken over by machines. So all the economists, all the reasonable ones at least, will tell you that technology as a whole, you know, increases the global wealth produced by hour of human labor. And so increase the overall wealth. The question is not whether the robot will take your job. The question is, how will the wealth produced by automation be distributed among the population? Is it going to cause a further increase in wealth inequality? Or, you know, are governments and voters going to come to their senses and, you know, figure out that wealth has to be properly redistributed through taxation or whatever? So, you know, we're starting to become political, which I am on my Facebook page, but I'm pretty vocal about this. But I mean, robots are not coming for your jobs. They're going to increase the overall wealth of humanity and health as well.
Right. Yes. No, it's a lot of exciting things to look forward to, a lot of work to be done on many fronts. Yeah. And my last question for you is, what legacy would you want to leave behind?
You know, progress towards understanding intelligence as a whole. So as an engineer and a scientist, I think the best way to understand something is to build it yourself, or to verify that a theory is correct is to actually implement an artifact that, you know, is a realization of that theory and verify that it works. And so, you know, I think the sort of understanding a bit more about the nature of intelligence is, you know, the legacy I'd like to have. You know, I already have a bit of that legacy already.
Oh, you've done it for sure. Absolutely.
I'm not entirely ready to retire yet, you know. I might have a few useful years before my brain turns into white sauce, but that's really what I'm after. That's what I've been after all my career. And, you know, along the way, kind of producing interesting technological artifacts, but really the understanding of intelligence is really what fascinates me, whether it's artificial intelligence or mechanical intelligence, or whether it's human or animal intelligence. And I don't believe in the concept of artificial general intelligence. I don't think there is such a thing as general intelligence.
You believe it's specific and discrete.
I think every intelligence is somewhat specialized, including human intelligence, even if we'd like to think that's not the case.
Well, Jan, thank you again. It's really been an honor to speak with you and to get your thoughts. I'm grateful for all you've been doing in this field, not just in your research, but in helping to develop norms of collaboration, as well as thinking about these issues of cooperation across cultures, and even, as you mentioned, the issue of distribution of wealth. There are so many ways that you've been leading, and we're grateful.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.